Chapter 10, To Yambu. With reeling limbs, we landed at Alwij, and finding a large coffee house above and near the beach, we installed ourselves there. But the Persians who preceded us had occupied all the shady places outside and were correcting their teeth with their case knives. We were forced to content ourselves with the interior. It was a building of arcless construction, consisting of little but a roof supported by wooden posts, roughly hewn from date trees. Round the tamped earthen floor ran a raised bench of unbaked brick, forming a divan for mats and sleeping rugs. My alias that day was severely tried. Besides the Persian pilgrims, a number of nondescripts who came in the same vessel were hanging about the coffee-house, lying down, smoking, drinking water, bathing and picking their teeth with their daggers. One inquisitive man was always at my side. He called himself a Pathan, Afghan settled in India. He could speak five or six languages, he knew a number of people everywhere, and he travelled far and wide over Central Asia. These fellows are always good detectors of an incognito. I avoided answering his question about my native place, and after telling him that I had no longer name or nation being a dervish, I asked him, when he insisted upon my having been born somewhere, to guess for himself. To my joy, he claimed me for a brother, Pathan, and in course of conversation he declared himself to be the nephew of an Afghan merchant, a gallant old man who had been civil to me at Cairo. We then sat smoking together with effusion. Becoming confidential, he complained that he, a Sunni or Orthodox Muslim, had been abused, maltreated, and beaten by his fellow travellers, the heretical Persian pilgrims. I naturally offered to arm my party, to take up our cudgels, and to revenge my compatriot. This thoroughly Sulaimanian style of doing business couldn't fail to make him sure of his man. He declined, however, wisely remembering that he had nearly a fortnight of the Persian society still to endure. But he promised himself the gratification, when he reached Mecca, of sheathing his charay, the terrible Afghan knife, in the chief offender's heart. At 8 a.m. on the 14th of July, we left Alwij, after passing a night tolerably comfortable by contrast in the coffee house. We took with us the stores necessary, for though our Rais had promised to anchor under Jabal Hassani that evening, no one believed him. We sailed among ledges of rock, golden sands, green weeds, and in some places through yellow lines of what appeared to me at a distance foam after a storm. All day a sailor sat upon the masthead looking at the water, which was transparent as blue glass, and shouting out the direction. This precaution was somewhat stultified by the roar of voices, which never failed to mingle with the warning, but we wore every half hour and we didn't run aground. About midday we passed by Sheikh Hassan al-Marabit's tomb. It is the usual domed and whitewashed building, surrounded by the hovels of its guardians, standing upon a low, flat island of yellow rock, vividly reminding me of certain scenes in Sindh. Its dreary position attracts to it the attention of passing travellers. The dead saint has a prayer and a fatiha for the good of his soul, and the live sinner wends his way with religious refreshment. Near sunset, the wind came on to blow freshly, and we cast anchor together with the Persian pilgrims upon a rock, one of the celebrated coral reefs of the Red Sea. Wading to shore at Masa Mahar, we cut our feet with the sharp rocks. I remember to have felt the acute pain of something running into my toe, but after looking at the place and extracting what appeared to be a bit of thorn, I dismissed the subject, little guessing the trouble it was to give me. It was most probably a prickle of the egg-fruit, or echinus, so common in these seas, generally supposed to be poisonous. Having scaled the rocky side of the cove, we found some half-naked Arabs lying in the shade. They were unarmed and had nothing about them except their villainous countenances wherewith to terrify the most timid. These men still live in limestone caves, like the Tamud tribe of tradition. Also, they are ichthyophagi, existing without any other subsistence but what the sea affords. They were unable to provide us with dates, flesh, or milk, but they sold us a kind of fish called in India bui. Broiled upon the embers, it proved delicious. After we'd eaten and drunk and smoked, we began to make merry. And the Persians, who, fearing to come on shore, had kept to their conveyance, appeared proper butts for the wit of some of our party. One of us stood up and pronounced the orthodox call to prayer, after which the rest joined in a polemical hymn, exalting the virtues and dignity of the first three caliphs. Then, as general on such occasions, the matter was made personal by informing the Persians in a kind of rhyme sung by the Meccan Gama that they were the slippers of Ali and the dogs of Omar. But as they were too frightened to reply, my companions gathered up their cooking utensils and returned to the golden wire melancholy, like disappointed candidates for the honours of Donnybrook. Our next day was silent and weary, for we were all surly and heartily sick of being on board ship. We should have made Yambu in the evening, but for the laziness of the Rais. Having duly beaten him, we anchored on the open coast, insufficiently protected by a reef, and almost in sight of our destination. It was about noon on the 12th day after our departure from Suez, when, after slowly beating up the narrow creek leading to Yambu Harbour, we sprang into a shoreboat and felt new life when bidding an eternal adieu to the vile golden wire.